This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us on a rather cold day. The polar vortex is pouring into North America, making a lot of people a lot colder than they're used to being. We're even colder than we're used to being. And a bitterly cold day in late January is a reminder of the importance of shelter in our part of the world. Most of us take it for granted. But Kelly Gores of the High Plains Fair Housing Center in Grand Forks helps people who face challenges finding a place to live. The mission of her center is to provide advocacy, training and education, and enforcement. She sat down with our John Harris to talk about her work for this week's Prairie Pulse television show.
Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
For the folks out there, what is the High Plains Fair Housing Center?
High Plains Fair Housing Center is a civil rights nonprofit. We're a private nonprofit. We're not an agency. We work to end housing discrimination, to advocate for people who are experiencing housing discrimination, help them get resolution for that. But then we also work our efforts to end housing discrimination in North Dakota. So we're a statewide organization. So we assist people across the whole state, even though we're located in Grand Forks.
Okay. So just North Dakota?
Just North Dakota, yeah.
Okay. Well, you mentioned your role there, education. So what is your role currently there?
So my role is to education outreach, so to make sure people are aware of their rights, make sure they're aware of what to do if they are experiencing housing discrimination, make sure everybody understands their rights and responsibilities under the Fair Housing Act, and just to do, you know, public outreach, that kind of thing, let people know how to get a hold of us. Have done some advocacy work in the past, or if we have some overflow, I can do some advocacy work and help people get resolution if they are experiencing housing discrimination. But my main role is to let people know what their rights and responsibilities are under the Fair Housing Act.
Yeah. Well, can you talk about the various forms of housing discrimination that there are?
Sure. The Fair Housing Act is a federal law that covers any kind of housing transaction or anything that has to do with housing, any kind of law or anything like that has to do with housing that discriminates against people based on their race, color, national origin, religion, sex, disability status, or because they have children or familial status. Here in North Dakota, we have additional protections for age over 40, marital status, whether you're married or if you're married, marital status, it's kind of a tricky one we could talk about later on. And public receipt of public assistance. So you can't be discriminated against if you receive a Section 8 voucher or you get veterans benefits, those kind of that public assistance. So the biggest type of discrimination you are going to see is that kind of disparate treatment. So treating one person in one of those protected classes that I mentioned differently than somebody who's not. So this might be not showing all the available apartments in a place. If somebody's in a protected class, then you would somebody else. Might be not wanting to rent to somebody because they have a disability, because they have children. Might be different terms and conditions. So you might charge somebody from another country a higher application fee or put them through more of a application process than you would a white North Dakotan, that kind of thing. So that's generally what you see. In terms of disability protections, there's also additional protections for disability that to allow persons with disabilities a reasonable accommodation or modification in their housing. So a denial of that is a form of discrimination that you see quite a bit.
Okay. Well, I have to go back to marital status.
Yeah.
You mentioned that. I mean, are you talking about married, single, or same-sex marriage?
Marital status, as far as I understand it, it's just whether you're married, single, that kind of thing. But if you're if you remember back in North Dakota law, we had laws where it was illegal to cohabitate mm-hmm. if you were not married and members of the opposite sex. So when that marital status was passed, that was kind of still under that law. So if you can be discriminated against because of your married status, but if you're not married and you're cohabitating, you can still be discriminated against. It's kind of just an interesting law thing. So, but if you can't, say we only want married couples here. We only want single, that kind of thing. So,
okay. Well, that gets a little tricky then because of the cohabitation law then, doesn't it?
Right. Well, we don't have that anymore.
Yeah,
so,
because,
right.
Yeah, but that would have been, I mean.
Yeah.
Does your group investigate these things, or how does that work?
We do. We do investigate housing discrimination in place. So we have a testing program, and it's kind of like secret. It is secret shopping for discrimination is what it is. It's testing is upheld by the Supreme Court. It's legal. It sounds kind of like a dirty thing, but it's not. It's the only way to find out if discrimination is really happening, unless it's blatant discrimination, unless there's a sign in the window or something like that. Most discrimination is going to happen with a smile and a handshake. So with our testing program, we use secret shopping. So we take somebody in a protected class, somebody who's not in a protected class, put them into a rental situation, application situation, a buyer's, because it's any kind of housing transaction. So it could be any kind of real estate transaction. So it might be going to apply for a mortgage, going to look at houses in a real estate with a real estate agent, that kind of thing. So we send in these secret shoppers, these testers, and they're not trying to get anybody to discriminate. What they're looking for is they're gathering evidence of how they're being treated. Are they being treated differently because of their status in a protected class versus somebody who's not? So we might send in somebody with a disability to look at a two-bedroom apartment, might go into a rental office looking for a two-bedroom apartment. They have a disability, an obvious disability, and somebody who doesn't, and see if they're being treated differently, see if they're given the same terms and conditions for the application process, for deposits, things like that. See if they're being told that the same amount, a number of units are available, that kind of thing. So what we're doing is gathering evidence. And then it's that person generally is not going to know if they've been discriminated against. That tester is not going to know if discrimination is happening. But when that evidence comes back to, we can record. So when that evidence comes back to the testing coordinator, he or she can look at it and determine, were they being treated differently? Were they being told the same thing? So and then we can either use that as an organizational complaint to stop that kind of discrimination. But what we often do is if people call in and are experiencing discrimination, we can use that testing to kind of mimic the discrimination they think they're experiencing to see if it's actually happening or not.
If you find there's discrimination with a group, individual, or whatever, what recourse do you have at that point then?
Right. So as an organization, we can file a housing discrimination complaint. So the Fair Housing Act, it's the 50th year anniversary of the Fair Housing Act this year. So in 1968, the Fair Housing Act was passed, but for about 30 years, any kind of fair housing issue had to go through the court system. So you had to get a lawyer. Mm-hmm. It was dragged out across, for years, and people just, moved away, lost interest. It's too much effort to go, from losing their housing situation. They just don't want to keep going through this, keep reliving that discrimination. So in 1988, during the Fair Housing Amendments Act of 1988, under the Reagan administration, that's when they added disability discrimination and familial status discrimination protections federally. But what they also did was put in an enforcement piece so that HUD can take these complaints, do an impartial have an impartial investigator look at the story, what's happening on both sides, and then they can determine whether they think discrimination, they can recommend that either discrimination looks like it's taking place and we should push this through to the court systems, and then it goes right into the federal court systems, or we don't think that there's a discrimination and have a no charge discrimination. A person could still take it to the court systems at that point, but it's a free, short, they have, they're charged with 90 days to complete this investigation and get some kind of remedy. And during the whole time that they're doing this investigation, they're trying to conciliate between the complainant and the respondent, so the person who complained and the person who the complaint is against. So they're always trying to find some kind of neutral ground that works, either whether it's getting that housing that you need, that you were denied, or some kind of getting out of a housing situation that's discriminatory. So they're always trying to negotiate. So we can take that testing evidence and either file a housing complaint to try to get those policies changed, if an organization or a company is discriminatory. So we can file that to get those policies changed, to get fair housing training, that kind of stuff. Or we can use that testing evidence if somebody calls to help their complaint, if they're filing. Here in North Dakota, we have substantial equivalency. So that means our state laws are as good or better than the federal laws. So our housing discrimination complaints go to the Department of Labor and Human Rights here in North Dakota. So they act as HUD, as an investigator and a conciliator.
Okay. Well, how many employees do you have?
We're growing. So we've grown. We're about 5 years old, our organization. But the last 3 years, we've had HUD funding. So we've grown quite a bit in those last 3 years. We now have 4 full-time employees and three part-time employees. So we just opened our field office out in Mandant. So we have a part-time employee out there working, doing the same thing, doing basically a mini High Plains for Housing Center out in Mandan. So that just opened in October, so that's exciting. We do have a field office here in Fargo, too, where we can come and do work. But so still relatively small, but we've grown quite a bit in the last 2 years.
Okay, well, that was my so you've got offices in Grand Forks, Fargo, and Mandan.
Yep.
Okay. Is housing discrimination any worse in North Dakota than it is in other states?
It's, you know, it's pretty much the same. Every time I do one of these fair housing training, every single time somebody says, well, that doesn't happen in North Dakota, right? And sure enough, it does. We see it. We see it every day. We see it. We have a pretty robust testing program now, and we're out there every week looking for housing discrimination, and we find some form of it every week. We're hoping it gets better and better the more education and outreach is out there and more people understand fair housing laws and that it's illegal to discriminate and understanding what that looks like more. But it's I would say, is at least on par with the rest of the nation.
Well, can you talk about some of the specific cases that have been brought to your organization?
Most of the cases, like I said, that we get in North Dakota and nationwide, most of the types of discrimination are against people with disabilities when it comes to reasonable accommodation, reasonable modification, or outright denying them housing because they don't want to deal with reasonable accommodations or modifications. So under the Fair Housing Act, disability protections that were added in 1988, the federal government recognized that people with disabilities and housing need accommodations in rules or policies so that they can live there and enjoy their housing just like everybody else. So it's kind of a lifting up for people with disabilities. So we're talking about leveling the playing field, and it's giving people, they can allow accommodations in rules and policies or modifications of their unit so they can enjoy it just like a person without a disability. So we see about 50% of all fair housing cases in North Dakota nationwide are against people with disabilities, and about 30% of them are about this denial of a reasonable accommodation or modification. One of a more recent one in this past year, we had, it's kind of ends up being twofold. We had two testers go in to a unit. They were actually, a woman had was being denied an apartment because she had an assistance animal. So they were going in to gather evidence for her case. And they went into the apartment and we're told they weren't allowed to have assistance animals, any kind of assistance animals in the unit, that they would have to pay a pet fee, so they couldn't have that accommodation. Because that's what an assistance animal is, right? You're asking for an accommodation to the rule of their pet policy. So they went in, and so they were told, no, you can't have your assistance animal here. And as they were walking out, the property manager said, where else are you looking? So they said, you know, oh, we're just looking at, around town in this area. And she said, well, whatever you do, don't go to such and such property because they'll just rent to anybody. And if you look around here, you'll notice there's no Somali families here. And we don't, I don't steer, but we don't rent to Somali, or I definitely steer. I don't discriminate, but I definitely steer. And steering is a form of discrimination. So steering is not telling somebody that I have a place for you to live here, but I have a place, not letting them know that you have availability here, but putting them, we have availability in this building where other Somali families might be or other families with children might be, that kind of thing. So she basically admitted to the testers. So then we had a case where we could help the client because we had her evidence that she was being discriminated against for having an assistance animal. But then we filed an organizational complaint to stop that kind of future practice of steering and to go through training and that kind of thing.
What can the state legislature do to help these situations?
I think first and foremost, they can listen to their constituents and what's going on in their housing situation. So we have an intake line. We get about 2/3 of our calls are just landlord-tenant issues that we can't really do much with. So we can only do fair housing issues. But what state legislators can do is really recognize that these laws are protecting individuals in their housing and how important that is. They can find out what are the stories, what are people experiencing. We will be sending out our annual report early next year so they can see what North Dakota is experiencing in housing discrimination. Be aware of that. Be aware that the landlord-tenant laws are always kind of being chipped away at in North Dakota, and that to always keep in mind that housing is tough for whether you're a property owner or you're trying to rent property, or it's tough because you're always dealing with people. So there's always kind of a little more emotion around housing issues, whether it's service animal abuse that people think that is happening, or other types of issues like that, or just abuse of reasonable accommodations, that kind of thing. But to be aware that those individual protections really need to be there.
So is the disabilities the most common form of discrimination there is out there?
It is. Yeah. Disability is the most common form, well, yeah.
I understand you recently had some staff members in Washington attending a HUD training academy. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we did. HUD called, it's an educational type meeting. So they had all the fair housing organizations like ours across the country come to Washington, D.C. just to have a formal fair housing training. We do this quite often. So all of our staff is formally trained from either HUD or the National Fair Housing Alliance Association, and we do continual education. Fair housing laws are always evolving. They're not changing, but fair housing is always evolving. So HUD called a meeting, and we all went out there, and we just learned, you know, what is happening in fair housing now, how they're kind of dealing with cases. It hasn't changed, but just kind of reemphasize what, you know, fair housing rights and responsibilities people have, how to handle these intakes, how to deal with investigations, best practices kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. With that said, though, are there companies or organizations within North Dakota that are particularly tricky to work for clients at times?
It's going to vary regionally where you are. We've had a lot of success working with the North Dakota Apartment Association has been very supportive of our efforts. We have a lot of success working with many landlords and property owners in North Dakota. One thing that we can do without going straight forward to that filing a housing discrimination complaint is we can advocate for people. So we can reach out and talk to their landlord and, you know, remind them of fair housing laws, but also, you know, look at that fact-specific situation and find out if there's something that can be done before it goes to a housing discrimination complaint. And most of the time, landlords are pretty receptive of that kind of thing. And we do have good partnership, like I said, with the Apartment Association. Generally, if it's a smaller property owner, they just didn't know. They weren't aware of fair housing laws, right? And so that's kind of an easy fix, in a sense. We can talk to them. We can send them information. They can call us if they hear, you know, that they are worried that they might be discriminating without necessarily realizing it. We have plenty of information on our website, and they can call us, and we can point them to fair housing law resources. We're not lawyers. We're advocates, so we can't give them specific advice.
How is your organization funded?
We have multiple grants. So when we started 5 years ago, it just started as a group of concerned citizens who saw a need for a fair housing organization. There was one in North Dakota that I think it dissolved around 2008, 2009. So there was a need. So basically for 5 years, housing discrimination was going unchecked across the state. So they saw this need, and they just started it with little funding, if any, from CDBG funding from cities, some just small grants, that kind of thing. And starting in 2016, we got our first HUD grant, so our Fair Housing Initiative grant, which is a more substantial, larger sum of money. It's over $100,000, the first grant. So we get the bulk of our funding from HUD specifically. So we have two grants right now from HUD. One is education and outreach to let people know what their rights are and responsibilities are in fair housing. And the other one is for the testing program. And the testing program one, we got funded for 3 years. So the education outreach you have to reapply for every year. So most of our funding comes from that.
Where can people go for more information?
They can go to our website, www.highplainsfhc.org. They can call our intake line if they're experiencing housing discrimination, 701-203-1077. They can call our offices in Grand Forks, or just do a Google search for High Plains Fair Housing Center, and they can get in touch with us.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Prairie Public's John Harris talking with Kelly Gores with the High Plains Fair Housing Center in Grand Forks. You can see their discussion and the rest of the Prairie Pulse television show this Friday at 7:30 Central. Next on Main Street, Natural North Dakota.
You've heard our short and sweet member drive is coming up. You can tell because your mouth is already watering. And maybe you faithfully got your sweetie a box of decadent cocoa truffles year after year. But this year, turn over a new leaf and do something different. Do something for yourself.
Three words for you. Treat yourself.
Picture yourself hiding in a closet, devouring a cocoa truffle from Nicole's Fine Pastry. That's right. Dark Calibo chocolate melting in your mouth and melting your cares away. And then telling your significant other that Prairie Public canceled the short and sweet member drive. Shh. Your secret is safe with us. Call 1-800-359-4145. Go to prairiepublic.org or text the word support to 484848 and click on the link we sent. A $10 a month membership gets you 1 pound of cocoa truffles. And you can even compose a love poem to yourself. Roses are red, violets are blue. You know who's awesome? You. Life is short. Eat more truffles. From Nicole's and Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura used to teach college biology. Thankfully for us, he continues to write and voice Natural North Dakota, a series of essays about the plant and animal life that live on the Upper Great Plains. Today, Chuck's topic is the bull elk.
I recently had the good fortune of getting a good look at 4 bull elk in the Turtle Mountains while cross-country skiing. When one thinks of elk in North Dakota, the Badlands and Theodore Roosevelt National Park may come to mind. I suspect a few among us are aware that the Turtle Mountains supports a sizable elk population. Historically, elk ranged over most of the state. Their abundance in the 1800s has been well documented through the journals of several early traders and explorers. Alexander Henry, for example, noted that along the Red River during the fall of 1800, and I quote, "large herds were seen at every turn of the river," unquote. Lewis and Clark observed them frequently as they traveled the Missouri River in 1804 and 6. John James Audubon, Prince Maximilian of Weed, and even Theodore Roosevelt wrote about the abundance of elk in the western portions of North Dakota. But as European settlement commenced, their populations dropped considerably. So by the late 1800s, they were becoming rare, and by the early 1900s, they were on the verge of extirpation. But of course, that has changed considerably. Robert Seabloom notes in his Mammals of North Dakota from 2011, the 3 populations now exist in the state. Elk arrived in the Pembina Hills in the 1970s, probably from adjacent Manitoba. A population in the Badlands and Kildare Mountains area can be traced back to the 1970s and is assumed to have been established by escaped animals from Fort Berthold Indian Reservation. And of course, Theodore Roosevelt National Park supports an elk population which was established in the 1980s by introductions from Wind Cave National Park in South Dakota. The Turtle Mountains can now be added to the list. The population here may have been established back in the 1940s by a few elk that escaped from an introduction or introductions in the Kildare Mountains. This population has been recently estimated to be somewhere around 400 to 500 animals, and perhaps even much larger because about half of the Turtle Mountains are in Manitoba. Today, the state supports a huntable population of elk. A quick review of the North Dakota Game and Fish Department's 2018 elk hunting statistics showed 6 units for elk with 401 licenses available, 40 of which are for the hunting unit that is basically the Turtle Mountains. The future looks bright for elk in North Dakota, so as you travel about, be on the lookout for them. You never know when a few of these magnificent animals will make their presence known. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, a Harvest Public Media report about internet access to the poor in rural areas. And we'll hear about a new Prairie Public Television production titled Minnesota's Unsung History. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Now that voters have approved a change in the state's constitution regarding ethics for elected officials, there has to be legislation to get it implemented and to write rules. Lawmakers are looking at 2 competing measures. One is sponsored by Fargo Democratic Senator Tim Mathern. He calls his measure a simple 3-part bill.
It says, get the Ethics Commission to work, study the sticky issues in the interim, and then in the next session, the full implementation.
The other bill is sponsored by House and Senate Republican majority leaders. Mathern says to him it appears the GOP bill is more defensive. But Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner of Dickinson says he's interested in taking the best from both bills and making something that's workable and understandable.
You know what my biggest concern is? It's going to take some everyday people that are going to be afraid to come down here and be a part of the process because they're afraid they're going to violate some ethics measures.
Wardner says he agrees with Mathern that a two-year study of how to make it work is warranted. If you thought it was cold overnight, you are right. The lowest temperature reported by the National Weather Service in North Dakota?
49 below in Rugby.
The Bismarck National Weather Service forecaster Adam Jones says there were some other reports of temperatures in the mid-40 below range, and it remains cold. Jones says the wind has died down in some areas of the state, but the National Weather Service has wind chill advisories and warnings over most of North Dakota.
The reason we still have wind chill headlines is simply due to the fact that it's so cold, even just a slight breeze makes it even that much colder. And then later on tonight, we're expecting temperatures to fall again, and it's still going to be rather brutal.
Jones says early next week, the state has a chance to see more snow as a low pressure system develops over Colorado, and it could bring some accumulating snow to the northern plains. But he says it's still too early to tell who will get the snow and how much will fall. And the Minnesota legislature could consider a measure to name the Labrador Retriever as the state's official dog breed. Republican Senator Carrie Root of Breezy Point says the bill is designed to teach school children about how a bill becomes law.
Part of this will be a website where we think children can go to learn a little civics lessons, because it might not be fun to follow a tax bill or maybe an elder abuse bill, but they might be really excited to follow a dog bill.
Rude says she also wants to raise awareness about rescue and service animals. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Thank you for listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. A new study from the U.S. Census Bureau shows rural counties have significantly less access to high-speed internet. And the disparity is even greater in rural areas with high rates of poverty. This creates a major problem for economic development efforts. Harvest Public Media's Jonathan All reports the solutions will have to come from several directions.
And they're all custom bacons today. Have several different machines, but that's probably the one that's used the most right there, that bacon slicer.
Janice Thomas is walking through a giant meat cooler at Swiss Meat and Sausage in the small unincorporated village of Swiss in central Missouri. Workers are cutting bacon for a special order. Swiss Meat and Sausage is celebrating its 50th year in business, and Thomas says it's been very successful. But they need to grow, and that means more business online from far-flung customers.
Well, I think that's the one area where we need to expand. I mean, if there's one place that has some room, that's what we're hoping to expand in the future, is with our online ordering.
But that's where the problem comes in. Swiss has minimal internet access. It's not high speed, and it's unreliable. Thomas says it's her biggest barrier.
When it goes down, we can't get the orders, so it relies on that 100%.
Thomas says they invested in a satellite internet backup, but it's expensive and not reliable. It's a common problem for businesses that are in rural areas or looking to locate there. The lack of broadband service and no single unified effort to resolve the problem makes economic development much more difficult for regions that need to attract jobs. The struggles go well beyond traditional rural economic sectors like agriculture. Brewer Science is a microchip manufacturer based in Rolla, Missouri. They looked to build a plant in the nearby small town of Vichy 5 years ago. Rob Chin is the company's network administrator. He says the lack of good internet access was a major issue.
It did force us to redesign how some of our manufacturing systems worked to tolerate internet outages. We also added a backup connection from a wireless ISP, which is just the bare minimum we need to continue production.
Chin says if it weren't for the local company owner being committed to locating in a rural area, the business decisions would have made them look elsewhere. Tim Arbeiter says the struggles those companies face are played out countless times in rural communities across the Plains and Midwest. He's the director of broadband development for the Missouri Department of Economic Development. Arbeiter says businesses looking to expand or locate in a rural area start with a simple question.
do I have the basic infrastructure needed to help me be successful in my respective business? And basic infrastructure now includes broadband, now includes high-speed internet. It is the utility of today.
Arbeiter says the answer often isn't what businesses want to hear, and they look to places with better internet access. While rural broadband issues are known and increasingly well-documented, the solutions are not as clear. Marshall Stewart leads the University of Missouri Extension and has adopted rural broadband as a pet project. He says there is a historical example, the Rural Electrification Project during the New Deal.
When it did, then it began to allow people to do commerce better. It allowed them to move product from the farm to the city. And I think what's happening in today's terminology is another iteration of that. Broadband today is what rural electrification was nearly 100 years ago.
But Stewart says the big difference is that rural electrification was a federally funded program.
The idea that there's going to be a sweeping federal effort to just fund broadband internet for the country, that's probably not going to happen wholesale.
Instead, he says, the solutions will be a combination of improved technology that will make it easier and cheaper to get broadband to rural areas, as well as targeted state and federal grant programs. The USDA announced in December it's offering $600 million in grants and low-interest loans to help expand broadband in rural areas. But businesses will rely upon internet service providers, rural co-ops, and local governments to apply for and get that federal money. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that focuses on America's farm and rural issues. Next on Main Street, a new Prairie Public Television production that uses music to share history.
But first, we want to let you know about your opportunity to support the programming that you enjoy here on Prairie Public. And as a special thank you, you get a 1 pound box of cocoa truffles. Here's the deal. You call 1-800-359-4145 or click and join at prairiepublic.org or text the word support to 484848 and click on the link. And starting at just $10 a month, we will send a box of decadent cocoa truffles in time for Valentine's Day to anywhere in the continental United States. Get cocoa truffles in time for Valentine's Day. 800-359-4145 or prairiepublic.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. The past is full of untold stories. A new collaboration between singer-songwriter Elisa Karen and Prairie Public will give voice to some hidden history. Minnesota's Unsung History premieres Monday, February 4th at 8 p.m. Central on Prairie Public's television service. Main Street's Ashley Thornburg visited with Corinne and Prairie Public production manager Barb Gravel.
Elisa, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Barb, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
What is Minnesota's Unsung History?
Well, let's see. Minnesota's Unsung History, stories by Elisa Karen, is a bit of a compilation of music videos that tell the history of some unlikely characters and situations in the region, that is Minnesota and North Dakota. We worked with Elisa Karen to not only write and research these topics, but to create a musical tune that goes along with them. And then we recorded music videos in the field for each of them. And this is 14 songs that we worked with her on.
Elisa, why did you want to join this project?
Well, I have this lifelong fascination with oddballs. And as an artist, as a singer-songwriter, I kind of found my rhythm, if you will, when I started writing about oddballs in history. And the songs I was writing when I pursued those topics were so fascinating to me, and they really resonated with my audiences. So I kept looking for more and more stories about those individuals who I describe as too fascinating for the history books. And I was so fortunate in meeting Barb sometime after I moved from New York City to Minnesota, and she invited me to be part of Prairie Musicians, her wonderful series featuring local musicians. And when she heard some of the material that I do about oddballs, she thought, hey, maybe there's – and I shouldn't speak for you, Barb, but you and Bob were talking to me about, hey, maybe we can do some more with this material. And so they took some of the songs that I had already written and they proposed some other topics. And together we made these mini music video documentary films. And what I love is that the work that Barb did really takes these – videos, these topics, to such a whole new level. They really expanded what I could do as a musician and a songwriter and showed so much more of the material, and I just love them.
And the Bob you're referring to is Bob Dambeck. He is our retired director of television. Barb, what do these songs add to a documentary?
Well, let's see. We have included them in documentaries like the Civilian Conservation Corps and Steamboats on the Red. And I feel what they add is a snapshot of the entire documentary in one song, a musical look at what the topic is and why it happened. Even, for example, our Wet versus Dry documentary, The Story of the Prohibition, this can give you a fun, lighthearted musical look at exactly what the whole documentary talks about.
And they're catchy.
Thank you.
Let's hear one. Let's take a listen to Root Beer Lady.
I live in the Boundary Waters in northern Minnesota. I live the life I want and I wouldn't change it one iota. Lived here most of my life, here on a lake called Napa, living mostly happy, mostly alone. I'm a strong, strong woman in my wilderness home. And I'm all about root beer. Root beer. Root beer. Root beer.
The first time I heard that song, that is not where I thought you were going with strong woman living alone in the wilderness. I was like, wait, what is root beer?
What does root beer have to do with this?
What does root beer have to do with this woman?
Well, Dorothy Moulter was this fascinating woman, really inspirational in that she followed her own path. And her path led her to live alone on an island in Knife Lake in the Boundary Waters without any power and without running water. And she lived there alone after her partner died. And the way that she supported herself was that every summer when the tourists would start canoeing through her area, she would provide homemade root beer to them and she'd sell it. And that's how she'd make her income. And she became famous in the Minnesota Boundary Waters canoeing community. And so She found a way, a very unusual way, to live the life that she wanted. And I have so much respect and admiration for her for doing that.
Well, I got to see a preview of Minnesota's Unsung History. And again, it premieres February 4th at 8 o'clock Central on our television service. I mean, when you talk about this woman making root beer, this is not, you know, putting a flavor capsule in a soda stream or whatever. I mean, she was harvesting ice from the river in order to refrigerate this. Barb, where did you get the archival footage and photos for this?
There in Ely, Minnesota is actually a Dorothy Moulter Museum.
I love it.
And we contacted them and they sent us many archival photos and were very, very wonderful to work with as far as supporting this effort to have her story told. And of course, when we post or when we produce any documentary or any video, we post it to YouTube, to our YouTube channel, and of course Facebook. So it's all over the world. And so to get that kind of publicity, I'm just tickled that we were able to work with the Dorothy Moulter Museum.
Can we still get this root beer today?
Yes, you absolutely can.
All right.
Yes, it is sold around Minnesota.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
Elisa, how do you do your research?
I get my material and my information about it whatever way I can. And sometimes that means like a local public library that has the one manuscript that some local person wrote about the topic, like Herman Finck, who's featured in my song and the video in this in this show called When Feathers Flew. Or sometimes it's going to a museum, like with the Hormel girls. There was a feature on them at the Spam Museum in Austin, Minnesota, and I was so taken with that story as well.
Yeah, you can't get too far into Minnesota history before you get to Spam.
I know, right?
Exactly. I just wanted to add that we are so lucky to be able to put the show on due to the Minnesota Legacy Amendment grant.
Yeah.
And so many of the songs, not all of them, with regard to Minnesota topics.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen to Hormel Girls.
I left the world with a pink slip in my hand. It was back to the kitchen till Hormel gave me a chance. He said, military ladies, come and drum for me. Military ladies, find out what we can. Some more. The drummers learned to dance. Then the new girl strut out and he gave him a chance. He said, you can perform and sell door to door. So during the day we go store to store saying, hey ho.
I think I hear a little influence of the Boogie Woogie Bugle Boys.
You
from
got
Company
it.
B right there.
Yes.
My
definitely.
Grandpa made me sing that song all the time. You know, this video has some great costuming too. You know, you're danced. Well, if you hear a song like that, you can probably picture the dress from that era. Who does the costuming for these?
That was kind of a collaboration, I believe. Yes. There were moments of me taking photographs of myself in my bathroom mirror and texting them or emailing them to Barb saying, would this work? And there were moments of Barb saying, hey, I've got this for you, like the nun's habit.
Exactly, okay. Yes.
Did you have that?
That dress I had and still have in my closet.
Wait, what? Why do you have a nun's habit?
Oh, not the nun's habit. The nun's habit was Barb.
Oh,
the Hormel girls.
Why do you have a nun's habit?
That was a loan from the West Fargo High School Theater Department.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So,
lots
like I said, we use all of our resources,
all of them.
Don't we? Yes, exactly.
In one of the songs, Chaska, features a fur coat mm-hmm. that was the Wadena Historical Society's mm-hmm. contribution. Wadena County.
That was amazing. And we actually recorded that video at Fort Abercrombie. And some of the others were recorded, for example, at Bonanzaville in West Fargo mm-hmm. or Buffalo River State Park, the Fargo Theater. We recorded some. And then we recorded some video for Mail Order Bride of some wedding dresses at the Emily Reynolds costume collection at North Dakota State University. So I tell you, we tapped a lot of resources,
we did.
Didn't we?
Yeah, Lisa. And it was so much fun.
Welcome to being from a nonprofit.
Right?
Fun.
Elisa, Did you do a lot of work on stage? You seem like you probably have a theater background.
I do. I okay. do. And I've been performing as a singer-songwriter for a long time. Gosh, we're nearing 20-some years now. And I've been taking a little bit of a break raising two small boys, which
little,
takes up a little more of my time these days.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'll be back on stage pretty soon.
I bet you're singing them a lot of fun bedtime songs.
I do. And then it's always interesting and humbling when the children say, Mommy, stop singing.
They're so nice.
Kids these days.
They're such critics.
Fun.
Oh, they are. Who did the location scouting for you, Barbara? Was that you?
I pretty much did it myself. I have a great team of editors and videographers who we all kind of pitch in, and they have ideas. I know a lot of the shoots we used a boom camera, so we were able to get some really neat shots. And I know at Buffalo River State Park, we had a four-wheeler, and we were getting around. Golly, the mosquitoes. Do you remember that,
Alyssa? Oh, yes.
So many mosquitoes everywhere.
Spraying
we were getting eaten
spraying.
Alive. And I'm going to spring a little something on Elisa that she probably doesn't realize, but in the credits of the program, we have a bloopers segment.
Oh, no.
Yes, it's so much fun.
That will be interesting.
So, yes, that will be February 4th at 8 p.m. You'll want to stay tuned for
the bloopers
at the end of the show from all of our field shoots.
There were a lot of bloopers, I'll tell you that much.
This one sounds like it was really a lot of fun for the television team. I mean, editors even just... There's one during the Prohibition song where there's a little whiskey jug bouncing around. a lot of fun here. You don't always get to do that with documentaries.
Not all the time. And this was a little bit out their comfort zone, but they loved it because they got to use these special effects programs like After Effects and Motion. And not that you know what those are, but some of the listeners may. But it was fun to incorporate little chickens and feathers on mm-hmm. When Feathers Flew and beach balls. And during Sister Lumberjack, there's kind of a little animated nun who kind of runs around on the screen. We thought it important to have the lyrics at the bottom of all of the songs so that the viewer could internalize the history, in essence, of the song. Some mm-hmm. of the lyrics go by a little bit fast, and we wanted everyone to realize exactly what the song was about with relation to the historical element of the song.
Which I really appreciated the song as the songwriter. Yes.
Yes.
Well, you are a songwriter. You're also an author. You've written a book. Is it 100 Miles to Nowhere?
You got it.
Yeah, from the detailing the move from New York City to New York Mills. Is your writing style different when it's a song versus a book?
I think absolutely. They're such different mediums. But one thing that's been very evident to me is that the fact that I started as a songwriter has really aided my prose writing, because as a songwriter, the real estate in a song for words is precious. You have so little room. So the word choice has to be absolutely perfect. And so as a prose writer, that experience gave me the ability to really craft sentences and paragraphs where I tried not to waste words, where I tried to make sure that every word counted.
Sure. Well, you can't exactly write War and Peace and condense it down to 2.5
Exactly.
This gal could.
I want to hear it. Go right now.
I'm
just kidding.
No prep.
Next project. Barb, what else is the television department working on?
Well, as a matter of fact, very shortly here, we are going to be recording the next season of Prairie Musicians. We have 8 amazing groups that will be coming into the Fargo studio to record their 30-minute shows, and those will premiere in June of 2019. So that's always an amazing project for my staff and myself. And then we have some amazing documentaries. We have the Elba Woods documentary, which is taking a look at the 1942 Warriors basketball team from Elba Woods, North Dakota, and their journey into finally getting the State B Basketball Championship Award that they were due.
A fun one too.
So that will be in May of 2019. And then we have another, Bob Dambach is finishing up another Germans from Russia documentary titled Women Behind the Plow. And we have interviewed, oh my goodness, many beautiful women from all different generations and them talking about their involvement in agriculture mm-hmm. in the German-Russian world, in Strasbourg, Linton, Wishick, Ashley, all those towns we revisited. And we have women in their 80s all the way down to their 20s who are right now embarking on a career in agriculture and the differences over these generations of time. Mm-hmm. But yet the importance in their community and frankly in our world. So that's amazing. Another series of Painting with Paulson is going to be broadcasting or premiering in April. And so many fun things.
Alisa, in addition to condensing War and Peace down to a song, what are you up to next? I know you're doing some traveling.
Oh, yeah. We are about to go to Colombia, so I'm packing fervently for that.
Excellent.
I'm working on a mystery novel. That'll be my first work of fiction, so that's going to take up some time. And I'm actually going to be the keynote speaker for the North Dakota Women's Agricultural Society in March, which is I'm just thrilled about. And I'll be doing some more live performances in May and June. So that'll be really fun.
Well, we always love to have the two of you on the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And let's end with Sister Lumberjack.
Sister Lumberjack could carry a man on her back. 6'2", every pound, hard won in the Minnesota outback. To lumber camps she tracked, through swamp wood and snow pack. She slept in thickets to sell elk tickets to Pulserb and Slovak.
Ashley Thornburg visited with singer-songwriter Elisa Karin and Prairie Public production manager Barb Gravel. Minnesota's Unsung History premieres Monday at 8 p.m. Central on Prairie Public's television service. Decoded 8 Book is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Decoded 8 Book for January 30th. The invention of the automobile changed the way people lived and traveled. It brought a system of highways into being and became a part of the American dream. Not everyone was immediately enamored with the new contraption. In January 1910, a report out of Washington noted that, in spite of the greatly increased use of the automobile, the self-propelling vehicle has been unable to depress either in number or value its rival, the American horse. The report asserted this because the price of a horse had increased over the past year, despite the automobile's arrival. However, the car was on the rise. By 1912, auto shows were in full force. On this date, residents in Grand Forks could get a demonstration of the new Buick and take a free ride. In February of 1917, an auto show was conducted at the Armory in Minot, and the show included a musical and vaudeville program to furnish something new and novel in the way of conducting an auto show. In March of that same year, an auto show section of the Weekly Times Record in Valley City noted that it was Chalmers Day at the automobile show, and that every day was Chalmers Day because so many people want this car. A poem modeled on the song America, My Country, Tis of Thee was published anonymously in newspapers across the country. It pokes fun at the car and begins like this. My auto, tis of thee, short road to poverty, of thee I chant. I blew a pile of dough on you 3 years ago, now you refuse to go, or won't or can't. Through town and countryside, you were my joy and pride, a happy day. I loved the gaudy hue, the nice white tires new, but you're down and out for true in every way. To the old rattle box came many bumps and knocks, for thee I grieve. Badly the top is torn, frayed are the seats and worn, the whooping cough affects thy horn, I do believe. Today's Decoded 8 Book was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Decoded Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
One more reminder that we are in our short and sweet membership drive. You can give $10 a month, and we'll send a beautiful box of delicious hand-rolled cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry to anywhere in the continental U.S. in time for Valentine's Day. Contribute $15 a month and receive two boxes. $20 a month will get you three boxes, and so on. The important thing is that you'll be supporting what you're listening to right now. Main Street and Prairie Public. Our radio service is member-supported. That means we rely on you, not to just listen, but to participate. And you can do that by going to prairiepublic.org or texting the word support to 484848 and click on the link we send, or call 800-359-4145. Thursday on Main Street, Letitia Mazzaro-Hellerud will join us to discuss her new book, Turning Points, True Stories of Thriving Through Adversity. Sue Balcom will be with us for a Main Street Eat segment with snack ideas for your Super Bowl party. And we'll share this week's What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.